So great to have you guys with us. This week I've been away at a Boys Brigade leadership camp. It's not just Boys Brigade, we've had a bunch of other people kind of sneak in. We've got one of our guys from youth, Hedemir, down on the bottom left-hand side. He's in the second year of that. He went out for 3 nights on his own in the bush and survived. So that was pretty awesome. That's been great, and really just a time to hear from God and to spend time digging into God. So that's been great, and you'll see the two of the groups, two of our guys who are in the first stage of that, Aiden and Ben from our church went along there as well. I go along and I speak each night and spend a lot of time with the boys, like as a chaplain there. And one of the things that we talk about, we do a lot, especially in the first year, we do a lot of work like doing problem solving. And I don't know, does anyone like problem-solving activity kind of things? Yeah, great, 3 people. For the rest of you who don't like them, maybe it's just a frustration or, you know, why we do them, like we kind of try to explain this as we go through the week, we try to explain, yeah, you know that frustration that you had, or you know that one person who did everything and everyone else just stood there kind of bored because that one person knew everything, and you know, we kind of explain through our time together that it's more about the journey than it is about the destination. It's about how we go about rather than just the end point of it. And today I want to speak about that. I want to speak about the path that we take in life. Because so much of our lives look towards a destination. They look towards somewhere we want to go, where we want to be. But really, it's the path that we're on, the journey we take, that's the more important thing. That's the pathway to our destination. A number of years ago, probably about 15 years ago now, I was in a cross-country race. My wife and I lived in England for a number of years, and this cold winter's morning where it was, you know, cracked the ice to in the puddles kind of weather, I went and did this fun run. Fun being the kind of, yeah, you know, fun for a bit. And it was about, I think it was a 10K race, something like that. It was through forest and farmland. And so, you know, no leaves on the trees, but you know, beautiful, crisp, clear day. And I don't know if you've ever done a fun run before. Has anyone done a fun run? We've got some fun runners out here. Has anyone done a run that hasn't been fun before? Everyone else who hasn't put their hand up? And so, you know, there's different types of people at these kind of events. There are the hacks, you know, the people who are wearing t-shirt and shorts. They're just in it for the fun of it, for the event. And there are other people there, and these people are generally wiry and lean. They're wearing fairly bright coloured lycra, and they have watches that are probably more expensive than my car. And they want to not just run, but they want to know afterwards, every split time they want to break down the race, they want to know exactly how they can do better, and they're pushing themselves. The time is the most important thing for them in their race, kind of how they end up. Well, this race is going through the forest, and because of that, they had white arrows on the ground and on trees and to direct you along your path. There were multiple paths through, but there was only really one path that the race was on. And so, as was going through, we got about halfway through the race, and coming back, I was probably about midway. There's perhaps 300 people. I was about middle of the pack. Coming back towards us was the first 150 people. What had happened is that perhaps the front runner had realized he's been running for a while, or she, I'm not sure who, had been running for a while and realized there's no more white arrows. Where are the white arrows? And so perhaps they've had a conversation with number 2 and kind of said, do you know where the white arrows are? And he's like, no, I've just been following you, man. And then they kind of, the third person, have you seen any white arrows lately? No, I think we're going the wrong way. And they turn back, and then as it goes, that kind of like snowballs into an aerial view that just looks like a ball of people kind of hitting together of confusion, everyone looking around. Well, I look over and I see that someone has found a white arrow and had started to run. And I kind of thought, well, what is the etiquette in the midst of this? Do we, as middle runners, allow the front runners in their very bright and colourful lycra and expensive watches to go in front of us because they rightly were coming first? We decided against it, right? Everyone's going, no, who would do that? And for a split moment in the race, I was in touch with the first place. I was probably coming 10th. in a race of 300, middle of a 10K race. This was my moment. In running history, this was it for me. I was in a great position. It was fantastic. The end of the race, I was back to the middle of the pack. The fast, skinny guys in Lycra. They all made their way back to the front of the pack. But for me, at the end of the race, man, I had a great race. Well, it was fun. I had a story to tell. I really enjoyed my time having a run. But these skinny, wiry guys with their brightly colored Lycra, they did not have smiles on their faces. The times that they had were terrible. They had wasted time on the race. They were so upset. They were fuming, throwing their arms up, talking to race officials about arrows not being in the right place. But me, I just had a great race. The funny thing about races, paths that we take is that sometimes when we're going through life, we have a destination in mind and perhaps even a time that we'd like to get there in. But if we don't take the right path, then it's unlikely we're going to get to that destination. There is a reality that it's actually more about the actions that we take, not our intentions, that get us to our destination. It's the things that we actually do in life, not just that we want to get somewhere, but it's actually what we do gets us to the end, not just our hopes and our dreams. We might have big hopes and dreams. We might have desires. Perhaps some of our desires are a little, our hopes and dreams are on the end of fiction. Pretty much most of my son's ideas and dreams about his future in the realm of fiction. But, we still encourage him. He could be a millionaire. That's good for us too, right? But we generally, as we grow up, we start to have hopes and dreams for our future that fit into the realm of achievable. But when I speak to people and we have discussions and I counsel them about the things that have kind of gone wrong in their life, and maybe I ask them, what did you hope to be? Where did you hope your life would end up? What was the destination that you wanted? And no one says to me in the midst of that, I really hoped on my wedding day that we'd be divorced. No one says, I really hoped we'd be living in two separate houses and our kids would have to go to different directions every weekend. No one says, I really hoped that I'd end up in jail, or I really hoped that I'd lose my license, or I really hoped that I'd have no money and I couldn't afford food this week. No one says that. No one has dreams that are down that low. We all hope to be able to own a house one day, or we hope to be able to put food on the table. We hope we'd have a good relationship with our wife or a husband. We hope we'd have a good relationship with our kids into our old age so that they can use their millions to support us. And so we have all these hopes, but if our hopes don't line up with our actions, then we may have all the greatest of intentions, but it'll lead to nothing because we're not actually doing, we're just saying. There was a guy in the Bible who I think epitomized this. He had two things in his life that kind of define him, two people in his life that define him. His name was King David. He was known to be the greatest king. If you look through the Old Testament, you'll see a lot of different kings that kind of come and go. David was known to be the best of them. He kind of came through unlikely kind of a pathway to become the king. He started out just as a lowly shepherd boy, the youngest in his family. When the prophet Samuel came to anoint, God said that one of the brothers would be the next king. Well, David wasn't even brought out in the lineup. He was still just off looking after the sheep. So he was an unlikely kind of candidate. But we find out that through looking after sheep, he killed a lion and a bear, so he had some skills. And later on, he kind of slowly becomes a general in the army and then becomes a king. He was not just a great military commander, he was also a poet. He could play instruments, he could sing. He just kind of had things all going his way. It seemed as though he had this heart for God, and he honored God, and he loved God, and he was known to be the king who was closest to God's heart. So all things seem to go well for David. But there are two things in David's life that kind of define him. One at the start, one more towards the end. And it's with two specific people that he has these interactions with, let's say, that define his destination. The first one was quite a tall guy. And in his name, for anyone under 20, you can yell out, who is the tall guy that David fought against? 1, 2, 3... Goliath, excellent. All right, and for those over 20, who did he interact with later in his life that also defined his life. Does anyone know her name? Bathsheba. Yeah, we know this. David is like incredibly like well-known character, even to today, especially the David and Goliath. Like you can still hear sports commentators using this kind of term when you've got a strong, great team like the Broncos up against a really weak team like the Titans, which I sometimes support. And, it's a David and Goliath in a kind of battle. And everyone gets that means a little guy against a big guy. And people sometimes, name their kids David because David is such a well-known kind of character, an honorable guy in history. My middle name is David after my dad, but that name is kind of kept going on because of King David. He's such a great guy. We have some people who love irony. Maybe they call their pet chihuahua Goliath. like the name Goliath, we get means something big, but it's funny if we call something small Goliath. And so David and Goliath, still a well-known kind of duo, if it were. But the story goes that at this point of time, a few thousand years ago, before Jesus came, there was a nation of Israel that was supposed to be, as you read through the Bible, you'll see that they're supposed to be God's chosen people. The people that, if you were to look at them, you would get a picture of what it would be like to have God as your God and everything would work out well. They, however, were human and broken and they weren't actually perfect much of the time, just like us. And so when we look at the nation, they didn't always follow God in the way they should have. Well, at this one particular time, the nation of Israel were fighting against their enemies, the Philistines. So often we hear about the Israelites against the Philistines. It seemed as though one particular time of year they would kind of go out and war against each other, but instead of taking the whole army against another whole army, it was actually not a great thing to have two armies to attack each other, because what you'd end up with, the winners were really the losers, because they would lose half of their fighting men and another quarter perhaps would be maimed and be out of the fight. So they would disable themselves so much for the next attack, and another strong nation could just come through and wipe them out. And so instead of pitting one against the other, all the fighting men against all the other fighting men, they would put up a champion. One person that would be their best fighter to go up against the other nation's best fighter. And this is what we have with the story of David and Goliath. One year, whether they had been feeding Goliath horse steroids or something like that, this huge mountain of a man turns up on the plains and calls out to the Israelites. He yells out, every day he says, someone come and fight me. If you win, then we, the Philistines, will be your slaves. But if we win, you will be our slaves. And then he would go on and say, your God is so weak, your nation, you're so weak. And he said rude things about their mums. He was not a nice character, okay? And so Goliath's saying all this kind of stuff, all this smack talk, and the Israelites, they're like, man, are you going to fight him? I'm not going to fight him. Are you going to fight him? No one wanted to fight this guy because he was a mountain of a man. Until David comes along. And he hears Goliath ranting and raving and speaking all this kind of trash talk. And he says to the king, what? Who's going to go? Is there like such a lineup? What's the problem? Everyone wants to go, right? Everyone wants to do this? And, because I'll do it. And the king's like, wow, actually the lottery. Whoa, yeah, everyone wanted to do it. But David, gee, just seems as though you're the one. Yes. Oh, wow, great. Why don't you go out? Because no one else wants to go out. And So David goes, Goliath sees this boy, right? Probably 12, 13-year-old, and looks at him and just laughs. Wow, this is offensive to me, the great giant Goliath, that you would send such a boy out to fight me. And it was great. You've got to read the story. It's an incredible drama as you read through it. But as he's kind of like saying all this mean stuff, then David comes back. And remember, David, he writes songs. He's just the greatest wordsmith in the Bible. He's awesome. He said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, who you have defiled. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcass of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. Oh, yeah. Sorry, kids. We've got kids in there today, haven't we? Okay, it could be carcasses. Yeah, it's anyway, parents, you can explain that later. David just has this sense, he just knows God is with me. There is no way that you can stand against me, Goliath. There's nothing you can do. I'm out here. And he gets a sling and he gets a rock and boom, hits Goliath in the head. This huge mountain man falls down the ground, shakes as he hits the ground. And David goes and grabs his sword and does something that your parents will explain later. Now this is David at kind of his peak. He gets a bit of a reputation after this, right? Like who wouldn't get a reputation after that? He's known to be the giant killer, the one who could defeat the Philistines, and his fame grows. And a heap of things happen between here and his other defining moment. A lot of things happen. He ends up becoming a great general. There's some friction between him and the existing king. And finally, the existing king dies in battle. David is able to become the king. And under David's rule, the nation of Israel grows in land. Their people prosper. They do incredibly well for a number of years. David is hailed to be the great king that they always hoped they might have. Until when we turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11, and we read, "In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem." Everything else we read about David, he's doing so well, he's doing so much, he's growing the city, strengthening the walls, having this great army, they're going and defeating other armies, they're doing so, it seems as though God is just blessing them. And until we come to this point in time where this interesting thing occurs, where it says in the spring when kings go to war, David didn't go to war. And we read that and go, that's interesting, because David, you're a king. And you didn't go to war, but the spring is when kings go to war. So David was doing something quite unkinglike. Now, we don't know why this is. It may have been because there was some internal strife. Perhaps David needed to deal with some of the things that were happening in Jerusalem, and so sent his generals out to do the fighting, and he would deal with things. But perhaps it was that he had been off fighting wars for years and years and years, and he knew the wars. Perhaps he was getting a bit bored and he was like, maybe it's time for the generals to get a bit of practice and experience generaling and fighting the wars. I'll let you guys go out, get some experience. Or perhaps it was that he just was exhausted from all his leading. He needed a holiday while everyone else needed to go out. We don't know what it was, but what we know is that this is an interesting time that David is doing something different from what he usually did. And who knows that, you know, when sometimes difficult times come when we have hardship, when we have tough stuff happening. We recognize that in the hard times, something can come, a temptation can come our way, a difficulty, and it can kind of floor us. But also temptation can come when we're going through good times, when things are going well for us. Sometimes in the good times, we can fall because we can think life's going well, everything's going good, there's no worries here, and we can kind of go on cruise control, and that's when trouble can come. One evening when David got up from his bed and walked around the roof of the palace, from the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. David innocently going onto the roof, I mean, he was just probably out there praying for the people of his city, maybe, we don't know, but he was out there walking around on the roof. He couldn't sleep, and so he thought, I'll just go for a walk and I'll get tired and then I'll go to bed. And he notices someone. Perhaps because of his godliness, perhaps he was praying, and in the midst of that he noticed someone bathing and he thought, man, maybe I should pray for her. Perhaps he just spent a little bit too long, you know, wondering who that was he should be praying for, and he notices that she's quite beautiful, and he continues to stare in her direction. Now, it's interesting that he was already married at this time and he already had a wife that he should have been spending time looking at, but he chose instead to cast his eyes and remain looking at this beautiful woman. This last week, I've been on this camp in leadership, and at the start of the week, you know, you talk to some of these guys and they're like, oh yeah, it's, you know, I come from a Christian home, I'm really growing in a relationship with God, everything's cool, everything's fine, everything's all dandy. And as you go through the week, you start to really ask, how are you going? And we start to hear about the things that are going on in their lives, the distractions that come their way, the feelings that really they're not really that well connected with God after all. The disappointments and sadness, the way that they perhaps treat their parents at times, the way they treat others, siblings or friends. And one of the things that comes up every year is the reality that there are things that they see with their eyes on the internet that they know they shouldn't be looking at. And perhaps that's because they're just bored and they're just surfing and a pop-up comes up or something and they just click. And it takes them down a path of looking and getting hooked into looking and looking and looking. And it's so easy to go down that path and so innocent at the start. But we all know that we're only ever a step away from doing something that will define us. So David got up from his bed, he walked around the roof, he saw that the woman was beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Elam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." That should have been a bit of a flashing light for David, right? Like, as soon as he heard the wife of, he should have gone, "Oh, right, oh man, someone else's wife, I shouldn't." But instead, David called for her and he slept with her. And he thought at that point in time that was just one thing, just an emotion, just a step off the path. It was just a detour perhaps for a night. And then he found out that she was pregnant. And her husband was away. He was actually off fighting in David's army. Man, what a dog act for the king to do for one of his commanders. And so he calls back Uriah and he says to him, "How's the fighting going? How's the front lines?" And Uriah gives a report. And then he says, "Well, look, why don't you just go home, stay with your wife, and then go back to the fighting tomorrow?" And so he goes home, but he doesn't actually go home. He goes and sleeps with the guards. He says, I can't go home while all of my men can't be with their families, so I'm not going to be with my family. I'm going to just stay with the guards and go back out on the front lines. And David hears this, calls him in the next day and says, "Oh, Uriah, I just wanted to appreciate you so much. You're such a great guy. Why don't you come and have some dinner with me and maybe have a drink or two or three or four or five or six drinks later." Uriah has got a skin full and the king David's like, "Look, go home. Have another night. It's on me, you know, because I'm like your boss. I'm the king. Go home. Stay with your wife. It'll be fine. Go out tomorrow to the fighting." Uriah in his state goes and sleeps with the guardhouse again. He says, "There's no way I could go and see my wife. All my men. He's such a valiant guy. What an honorable soldier." Well, David's so upset by the honor of this great man Uriah, sends a letter back with Uriah, back to the front lines. And the letter read, "Put Uriah on the front line where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." Uriah ends up being killed on the battlefield. And David then, you know, knowing that Uriah's wife is pregnant, he says, "Look, for my fallen comrade, I'll take his wife to be my wife. I'll look after their child. I can't leave one of my soldiers who's died, his pregnant wife. That would be terrible. So what a great king. What a great guy David was. Oh, man, what a king. He took Bathsheba, his own wife, so he could look after this child." And he thought he'd gotten away with it. He thought that everything was fine. He thought this shameful thing that he had done had been covered over, except for that God knew what he'd done. God knew the realities of his heart. God knew this shameful reality, this shameful thing that he'd done, and he uncovered that in front of David and his court when he sent the prophet Nathan in to speak and share with David what God knew. Well, it all came out, the truth, the reality. And David's kingship was destroyed from that time on. He remained king. He asked for forgiveness from God. He sought that and it was given. And he remained in that role as king, but his kingship was never as good as before then. It defined his life. The actions that he took defined the path that he ended up on. He had constant conflict with his children and the people in his army. How could his army ever trust him fully again? And there was not any more spreading of the country. He kind of changed his kingship, went from the up and up to plateauing and then going into disaster as his children fought to become the next king. His life was defined by one great moment that set him on a path towards greatness as a king, and then another moment when he was sent on a path to his disaster because of the actions he took. And I guess in this, I just think, what paths do we take that perhaps we start off thinking, that's where I want to be. I want to be with God. We sing this, right? I want to be loving you, God. I want to give my heart to you. I give my life as a sacrifice. That's where I want to be. I want to be with you in heaven, you honoring, you saying, oh, well done, good and faithful servant. You've done so well. You've come into my kingdom. This is going to be, that's where I want to be. But then we take a step off the path. Then we take another step, perhaps a look that turns into another look, a click that goes to another click, perhaps a comment that turns into hatred, that turns into a dastardly kind of act, when we start to hate someone or when we go down that path, or maybe it is an argument that we just let fester and turn into bitterness, something that we feel guilty about that we ignore that guilt and it turns into hardness of heart. Whatever it is, we start to walk off the path that God has for us, the path that we intended to go on, and head down a different path. So I just want to say three things about ideas, perhaps, of what we might be able to do to stay on the right path, to be able to overcome the David syndrome of being great but then falling dismally. The first one is, I believe that we have to act like a Christian. And now go with me here, you're probably going, yeah, of course, we're all going to act like Christians, right? Like, and even if you don't feel like it, you just fake it till you make it. Well, let me say, David, at one point in his life, he didn't do what kings were supposed to do. And I think oftentimes we can be guilty of doing things that Christians aren't meant to do. Just as David didn't go out with his army at one spring, oftentimes we can not do the things. We may come to church and we may lift our hands. We may call out to God and sing great praise and worship songs. We may do that, but then we go and we secretly cheat on our taxes. Or we're talking about loving one another and then we don't even show any love for someone who's at the checkout doing our shopping, or we're in our workplace and we join in with the dirty jokes. We say we're one thing, but then when we're in a different situation, we act another. And so I think it's important to see, is my lifestyle living up to the name that I call myself, a Christ one? Is my life equal to what I say that I am? Are we living out the path we want to take, or is it just an intention? Is it just something we think about or try to just cover off when we turn up to church on a Sunday? So we need to act like a Christian. The second thing I think is important is, Alan, if you could click it because I can't remember it. Know your temptation to sin. David, I'm sure, would have thought that because he was so close to God, that, and everyone used to say, oh, David, you're such a great king. Oh, God has blessed you. God is working through you. This is an amazing thing. David, you're so good. I have no doubt that he was up on a pedestal to the point that he would think, oh, there's no way I'm going to do anything wrong. And then when temptation came, he falled. It's easy to be able to look at other people and see their sin and say, they are a bad person. Oh, look at them. Oh, see what they did? Oh, they're terrible. Oh. It's easy to be able to look at other people and believe that they could do wrong. But it's much harder to think that we could do wrong. I think that sometimes our pride can rise within us. Perhaps we just look at other sins and look at other people, the sins that they fall into and think, oh, I'd never do that, but they do that. They're terrible people. But I think we need to be aware that we're only one step away from a decision that could take us far away from the path that God intended us to be on. We're only one step away from doing something wrong. Sin is right around the corner. It's always something that we can fall into. We're not impervious to sin affecting our lives. When we're aware of that, we then start to shift our thinking. And instead of thinking in pride, how good am I? I'm the one that God loves. God's blessed me. It's all going to be well. But instead, we come to God with a humility and say, God, I'm aware that this could be my sin. I'm aware of my brother and what's happening with him. God, I'm aware that I'm just as equal in my failings. I can fail too. I can fall. I could be that guy. And the third thing that we need to do is that we need to keep a close and healthy relationship with Jesus. I think the one thing that we have as Christians that so many other people don't have, if we choose to do it, and this is a big deal, right? This is something that, I could just say, this is a great thing that we have, but if you're not doing it, then you don't have it. So if If you spend time thinking about your day, about your actions, about your life, if you pray then about your day, about your actions, and about your life, and then you allow something that is God's truth to speak into your life and your actions and your day, then you'll have an incredible benefit over other people in the world around you who don't do that, who allow their day, their actions, and their lives to kind of just steamroll down into a path that they perhaps didn't ever want to take. It's easy to be able to take the second step on the path that is away from our intention if we don't reflect upon our lives. And I think that's where we have the benefit if we choose to take it. If we choose to stop and reflect upon our lives, whether that's daily, I think that's the best way, daily spending time with God, or whether it's weekly, but we have the opportunity to stop and reflect. How have I been today? Have I grown closer to God? God, what do you want to show me? What do you want to reveal in my heart that needs fixing so that I can grow? Because too often people head down the wrong path because they're just not thinking about how they're going on the right path. We need to keep short accounts with God. I'm sure if David had daily devotion with God, it's so hard to be able to maintain a path of sin if you're daily coming back to God and asking for forgiveness. Because God's bringing that to your mind. He's speaking to you in those times of quiet when you allow him to speak to you. So can I encourage you? The more time we spend regularly touching base with God, whether that's just 5 minutes a day, which when we think about it, it's pathetic, isn't it? When we think about the God of the universe who loves us, who's given us 24 hours, if we're like, yeah, God, if only you made a 25-hour day, oh, then I would praise you for an hour. Maybe instead we should look at it and go, God, you've given us 24 hours. Man, that's amazing. Imagine if you've given us a 23-hour day. Ha, you've already given us 24 hours, so maybe there's time in there to spend 5, 10, 15, 20, half an hour sometime with God, reflecting on who we are, how we're going with our relationship with God, and allowing his word to speak into our lives. Because when we look at the path that we want to take, when we look at the end point where we want to be, so much of us have an end point, especially as Christians, that we believe that we want God to bless us, to grow us, and to use us. But if our steps aren't taking us down that path, then how can we truly expect that to happen? We need to make sure we're growing closer to God each and every day. That the commitments that we make, the words that we sing, aren't just things that we make on a Sunday, but are steps that we take every day of our lives, so that little by little we grow closer to the path that he wants us to lead upon. That little by little we get closer to that day when he does speak to us and say, well done, good and faithful servant. You've lived this life as I wanted you to live. Now come and enjoy eternity with me. Let's pray. Lord, you've given us some great examples in the Bible of people who fail just like we do, who choose paths that were not your intention for them, who step off and move into places that are dark and sinful. You give us those examples, Lord, and we pray that we might be people who might not need to go down those paths ourselves, but instead that we might listen to your heart, look at the mistakes of others and learn from them, so that we can grow ourselves, not to take their failings, but instead to walk a path that you want us to go down. I pray, Lord Jesus, that we as a church might be united in heart and mind to live lives that are in line with what you want us to be. Help us to love one another in this place. Oh, Lord, I do pray that might be our heart, that we might love one another here. And then as we're equipped to love one another here, you might send us out from this place so that we might love this world that you've placed us in. That you might help us to have a great heart for our community. That you might help us to see those around us who don't yet know you and be saddened by that and be drawn to want to speak to them about your glorious grace. Show us your love within us, Lord, so that we can pour out that love on others. We need your spirit to guide and lead us. And we ask for this morning, we pray. Amen. As we ask each Sunday, if you would like prayer, we want to be praying for you. There's opportunity at the end of the service or through this last song to come forward for prayer, but can I also encourage you? We hang out and have morning tea together. It's always a good time to be able to get to know one another and to spend some time talking about life. But can I encourage you that it can also be a great time to be praying for one another? If you hear of someone who's struggling, or if you're struggling, maybe share that with someone. You could come and share it with Mark or I, one of the elders, but you can also just share it with anyone here, because we are a church that loves one another, and our prayers are equal. No one's prayers are greater than another. So may we be sharing with one another, and may we grow as a family as we share our hearts. Thanks, team.